Welcome to the land of the living, Senator, for the moment at least.
Slowly, Hartman's mind drained into consciousness. There was a tinny taste in his mouth and a singing in his ears. His right upper arm ached as if from sunburn. Someone hummed a familiar song. A radio muttered. His eyes opened to darkness. He felt the obligatory twinge of blindness anxiety, but something pressed his eyeballs, and from the small stinging pull at the back of his head, he guessed it was taped gauze. His wrists were bound behind the back of a wooden chair. After the awareness of captivity, what struck hardest was the smells. Sweat, grease, mildew, dust, sodden cloth, unfamiliar spices, ancient urine and fresh gun oil, crowding his nostrils clear to his sinuses. He inventoried all these things before permitting himself to recognize the rasping voice. "Tom Miller," he said. "I wish I could say it's a pleasure."
Yes, Senator. But I can."
He could feel Gimli's gloating as he could smell his stinking breath. Toothpaste and mouthwash belonged to the surface-worshipping gnat world.
"I could also say you have no idea how long I've waited for this. But of course you do. You know full well."
"Since we know each other so well, why don't you undo my eyes, Tom?" As he spoke, he probed with his power. It had been 10 years since he'd last had physical contact with the dwarf, but he didn't think the link once created ever decayed. Puppet Man feared loss of control more than anything but discovery, and being discovered itself represented the ultimate loss of power. If he could get his hooks back into Miller's soul, Hartman could at the very least be sure of holding down the panic that bubbled like magma low in his throat.
"Gimli!"
the dwarf shouted. The spittle sprayed Hartman's lips and cheeks. Instantly, Hartman dropped the link. Puppet Man reeled. For a moment, he'd felt Gimli's hatred blazing like an incandescent wire.
"He suspects!"
Most of what he'd sensed was the hate. But beneath that, beneath the conscious surface of Gimli's mind, lay awareness that there was something out of the ordinary about Greg Hartman, something inextricably tied to the bloody shambles of the Jokertown riots. Gimli wasn't an ace, Hartman was sure of that. But Gimli's natural paranoia was itself something of a sixth sense. For the first time in his life, Puppet Man faced the possibility he had lost a puppet. He knew he blanched, knew he flinched, but fortunately his reaction passed for squeamishness at being spat on.
"Gimli,"
the dwarf repeated, and Hartman sensed he was turning away.
"That's my name. And the mask stays on, Senator. You know me, but the same doesn't apply to everybody here, and they'd like to keep it that way."
"That's not going to work too well, Gimli. You think a ski mask is going to disguise a joker with a furry snout? If anybody saw you grab me, they'll have little enough trouble identifying you and your gang." He was saying too much, he belatedly realized. He didn't want Miller dwelling too much on the fact that Hartman could make him and some of his accomplices. Whatever had put him out had stirred his brains like omelet batter. An electrical shock of some sort, he thought. Back in the 60s, he'd been a freedom rider briefly. It was an up-and-coming new frontier sort of thing to do. And there was always the hatred, heady as wine, the possibility of lovely violence, crimson and indigo. A Peckerwood State trooper had nailed him with a cattle prod during the Selma protests, which was too first-hand for his taste and sent him back north in a hurry. But it had felt like that back in the limousine.
"Come now, Gimli," said a gritty baritone in accented but clear English. "Why not have the mask off? The whole world will know us soon enough."
"Oh, all right," Gimli said.
Puppet Man could taste his resentment without having to reach. Tom Miller was having to share stage with someone, and he didn't like it. Little bubbles of interest began to well up through the seethe of Hartman's incipient panic. Hartman heard the scrape of feet on bare floor. Someone fumbled briefly, cursed, and then he caught his breath involuntarily as the tape was unwound, pulling reluctantly away from his hair and skin.
The first thing he saw was Gimli's face. It still looked like a bag full of rotten apples. A look of exultation didn't improve it any.
Hartman pushed his gaze past the dwarf to the rest of the room. It was a shitty little tenement,
like shitty little tenements pretty much everywhere in the world. The wooden floor was stained, and the striped wallpaper had patches of damp like a workman's armpits. From the general scatter of crunchy and crinkly trash underfoot, Hartman guessed the place was derelict. Still, a light bulb glared in the busted globe fixture overhead, and he felt a radiator drumming out too much heat the way every radiator in Germany did until it came down June. For all he knew, he could be in the eastern sector, which was a hell of a cheery thought. On the other hand, he'd been in German homes before. This one smelled wrong somehow. There were three other overt jokers in the room, one swathed from head to feet in a dusty-looking cowled robe, one covered with yellowish chitin dotted with tiny red pimples, a third, the furry one, he'd seen next to the van. The three young gnats in Hartman's field of vision looked offensively normal by comparison. His power felt others behind him. That was strange. He wasn't usually able to taste another's emotions unless that one was broadcasting strongly or was a puppet. He sensed a peculiar squirming in the power inside him. He glanced back, two more back there, gnats to the eye, though the scrawny youth leaning on the stained wall next to the radiator had an odd look to him. A man in his mid-30s sat next to him in a gaudy plastic chair with his hands in the pockets of an overcoat. Hartman thought the older man was subconsciously straining away from the younger. When their eyes met, he caught a quick impression of sadness. That's odd, he thought. Maybe tension had heightened his normal perceptions. Maybe he was imagining things. But something was coming off that kid as he grinned at Hartman. Something that prickled all around the edges of his awareness. Again, he had that evasive feeling from Puppet Man. A shoe crunched debris. He turned, found himself looking up at an enormous gnat dressed in suit coat and trousers of an odd tan green, almost military. The man had no tie. His shirt collar hung unbuttoned around a thick neck, open to a spray of grizzled blonde chest hair. Big hands rested on his hips, with the coattails swept up behind, like something out of a little theater production of Inherit the Wind. His long hair lay combed back from a high forehead. He smiled. He had one of those rugged, ugly faces women fall for and men believe. "A very great pleasure to meet you, Senator." It was the rolling sea swell of the voice he'd heard urge Gimli to remove his blindfold. "You have the advantage." "That's true. Oh, but I dare say my name won't be unfamiliar to you. I am Wolfgang Praller." Behind Hartman, someone tisked in exasperation. Praller frowned, then laughed. "Ah, now, Comrade Mjolnir, do I break security? Well, did we not agree that we must come out into the light of day to accomplish a task so important?" Like many educated Berliners, he spoke English with a pronouncedly British cast. From behind, Puppet Man felt a flicker of agitation at the name Mjolnir. It was Russian. It meant lightning. The Soviets had a series of communication satellites by that name. "What exactly is going on here?" Hartman demanded. His heart lurched at the words. He didn't mean to take that tone with cold-blooded killers who had him altogether at their mercy. But Puppet Man, coming suddenly into arrogance, had taken the bit in his teeth. "Couldn't you wait until the Aid at Amitié banquet to make my acquaintance?" Prowler's laugh resonated from deep in his chest. "Very good. But have you not figured it out? It was never intended you should reach the banquet, Senator. You were, as you Americans say, set up."
"Drawn to the bait and trapped," said a slight red-headed woman who wore a black turtleneck and jeans. "Set cheese for a rat, set a fine banquet to catch a fine lord."
"Rats and lords," a voice repeated. "A fine rat, a fine lord," it giggled.
It was a male voice, cracked and adolescent. The leather boy. Hartman felt a tickle run along the cord of his scrotum like the fingers of a whore. No doubt about it, he was getting emotion from him like static on a line. A hint of something potent, something terrible. For once, Puppet Man felt no desire to probe further. He feared this one. More than the others. Praller, these casual youths with guns, even Gimli. "You went to all this trouble to help Gimli here settle an old imaginary score," he made himself say. "That's generous of you."
"We are doing this for the revolution,"
said a youthful gnat with a blonde flat top and a heat lamp tan and the air of having worked hard to memorize the line. His turtleneck and jeans were molded around an athlete's figure. He stood by the wall, caressing the muzzle brake of a Soviet assault rifle grounded by his foot.
"You have no significance, Senator," the woman said.
She flipped her square-cut bangs off her forehead.
"Simply a tool, what your naive egotism tells you notwithstanding."
"Who the hell are you people?"
"We bear the sacred name of the Red Army Faction," she told him.
She hovered over a stocky youngster who sat cross-legged, fiddling with a radio perched on a warped wooden nightstand. He wouldn't meet Hartman's eyes.
"Comrade Wolf gave it to us," the blonde boy said. "He used to hang out with Bader and Meinhof and them. They used to be close like this."
He held up a clenched fist. Hartman sucked in his lips. Since the terrorist wars had gotten underway for true in the early 70s, it wasn't uncommon for radical attorneys to come to involve themselves directly in the activities of those they represented in court, especially in Germany and Italy. Apparently, if what the kid said was true, Prahler had been a leader in the Bader-Meinhof group and the RAF all along, without the authorities ever getting wind of the fact. Hartman looked at Tom Miller. "I'll rephrase my question. How did you get mixed up in this, Gimli?"
"We just happened to be in the right place at the right time, Senator."
The dwarf smirked at him. Puppet Man felt an urge to crush that smug face, to tear out the dwarf's guts and throttle him with them. The frustration was physical torment. Sweat crawled down Hartman's forehead like a centipede. His emotions were oddly distinct from Puppet Man's. His other self whipsawed from rage to fear. What he mostly felt now was tired and annoyed. And sad. Poor Ronnie. He meant so well. He tried so hard. The redhead suddenly slapped the seated man on the shoulder.
"You idiot, Wilfried, that was. You went past it."
He mumbled apology and dialed back. "Captured by the Red Army faction, acting in concert with comrades from the Jokers for a Just Society who have fled persecution in America." It was Comrade Wolf's voice, pouring like liquid amber from the cheap little radio. "The terms of his release are these. Release of the Palestinian freedom fighter Al-Muwazin, an airliner with sufficient fuel to take Al-Muwazin to a country in the liberated Third World. Immunity from prosecution for members of this action team. We demand that the Jet Boy Memorial be torn down, and in its place, a facility built to provide shelter and medical attention to Joker victims of American intolerance. And finally, just to poke the capitalist spine where it most hurts them, $10 million cash, which will be used to aid victims of American aggression in Central America. If these terms are not met by 10 o'clock tonight Berlin time, Senator Greg Hartman will be executed. We return you now to regularly scheduled programming."
"We have to do something."
Hiram Worcester tangled his fingers in his beard and gazed out the window at the patchy Berlin sky. Digger Downs turned over a card. Tray of clubs. He grimaced. Billy Ray paced the carpet of Hiram's suite like a tyrannosaurus with an itch.
"If I'd been there, this shit would never have happened," he said,
and aimed a green glare at Mordecai Jones. The hammer sat on the sofa. It was oak and flowered upholstery, and like many of the hotel's furnishings, had survived the war. Fortunately, they'd built stout furniture back in the 1890s. Jones made a dirty gearbox noise toward the center of him and stared at his big hands, which he was working into tangles between his knees. The door opened and Peregrine flew into the room. Figuratively, at least, her wings jittering on her back. She wore a loose velour blouse and jeans that muted the advanced state of her pregnancy.
"I just heard on the radio. Isn't it terrible?"
Then she stopped and stared at the hammer.
"Mordecai, what on earth are you doing here?"
"Just like you, Miss Peregrine. Won't let me out."
"But why aren't you in the hospital? The reports said you were terribly injured."
"Just shot a little."
He slapped his gut.
"Got me a pretty tough hide, kind of like that Kevlar stuff you read about in Popular Science."
Downs turned up a new card. Red 8.
"Shit,"
he muttered. But a van fell on you, Peregrine said.
Yeah, but see, I got these funky heavy metals replacing the calcium in my bones, so they're, like, stronger and more flexible and all, and my innards and whatnot are a lot sturdier than most folks. And I heal mighty fast. Don't even get sick, since I turned up my ace. I'm a pretty durable sort of dude.
Then why'd you let them get away? Billy Ray challenged, almost shouting. God damn, the senator was your responsibility. You could have kicked some ass.
To tell you the entire truth, Mr. Ray, it hurt like a son of a bitch. I wasn't good for much for a while there.
The mister came out differently than Ms. had. Billy Ray cocked his head and looked hard at him. Jones ignored him.
Lay off him, Billy, said Carnifex's partner, Lady Black, who sat to one side with her long legs crossed at the ankles before her.
Peregrine came and touched Mordecai on the shoulder.
It must have been awful. I'm surprised they let you out of the hospital.
They didn't, Downs said, splitting open the deck in his left hand to catch a peek inside. He released himself, smashed right through the wall. The public health people are kind of pissed about it.
Jones looked down at the floor. Don't like doctors, he muttered.
Peregrine looked around.
Where's Sarah? The poor thing. This must be hell for her.
They let her go over to the crisis control center in City Hall. No other reporter from the tour. Just her. Downs made a face and went back to his solitaire game.
Sarah took over a statement from Mr. Jones about what he saw and heard during the abduction, Lady Black said. He didn't give one before he left the hospital.
After the accident that triggered his wildcard virus, Jones had been held by the Oklahoma Department of Public Health as a lab specimen, a virtual prisoner. The experience had given him an almost pathological fear of medical science and all its appurtenances.
Funny damn thing, Jones said, shaking his head. I was lying there trying to breathe with this van on my chest, and I keep hearing all these people yelling at each other. Like little kids fighting on a playground.
Hiram turned from the window. The rings that had been sinking in around his eyes since the tour began were even more pronounced.
I understand, he said, bringing his hands up cupped before his chest.
They were dainty hands and fit oddly with his bulk.
I understand what's happening here. This has been a blow to all of us. Senator Hartman isn't just the last best hope for jokers to get a fair shake, and maybe Ace is too, with this crazy Barnett fellow on the loose. He's our friend. We're trying to soften the blow by talking around the subject, but it won't do. We have to do something.
That's what I say. Billy Ray slammed a fist into his palm. Let's kick butts and take names.
Whose butt? Lady Black asked tiredly. Whose name?
That sawed-off little bastard Gimli, for starters. We should have grabbed him when he was dicking around New York last summer.
Where are you going to find him?
He flung out his arm.
Hell, that's why we ought to be looking for him, instead of sitting here on our duffs, wringing our hands and saying how sorry we are the fucking senator's gone.
There are 10,000 cops out there combing the streets, Lady Black said. You think we'll find him quicker?
But what can we do, Hiram? Peregrine asked. Her face was pale, and the skin stretched tight over her cheekbones.
I feel so helpless.
Her wings opened slightly, then folded again. Hiram's little pink tongue dabbed his lips.
Perry, I wish I knew. Surely there must be something.
They mentioned ransom, Digger Downs said. Hiram punched his palm twice in unconscious imitation of Carnifex.
That's it. That's it. Maybe we can raise enough money to buy him back.
10 million's a lot of bread, Mordecai said.
That's just a bargaining position,
Hiram said, sweeping aside objections with his small hands.
Surely we can work them down.
What about their demands this terrorist dude be released? We can't do nothing about that.
Money talks, Dan said. Nobody walks.
Inelegantly put, Hiram said, beginning to drift here and there like an ungainly cloud.
But correct. Surely if we can scrape together sufficient funds, they'll leap at our offer.
Now wait a minute, Carnifex began. I'm a man of not inconsiderable means, Hiram said, scooping up a handful of mints from a silver salver in passing.
I can contribute a fair amount.
I have money, Peregrine said excitedly. I'll help.
Mordecai frowned. I'm not crazy about politicians, but shoot, I feel I lost the man and shit. Count me in for what it's worth.
Hold on, damn it, Billy Ray said. President Reagan has already announced there will be no negotiating with these terrorists.
Maybe he'll go for it if we throw in a Bible and a mess of rocket launchers, Mordecai said.
Hiram elevated his chin.
We're private citizens, Mr. Ray. We can do as we please.
We'll by God see. The door opened. Xavier Desmond walked in.
I couldn't bear to sit alone any longer, he said. I'm so worried. My God, Mordecai, what are you doing here?
Never mind that, Des, Hiram said. We've got a plan.
The man from the Federal Criminal Office tapped his pack of cigarettes on the edge of the desk in the crisis center in City Hall, shook out a cigarette, and put it between his lips.
What on earth were you thinking of permitting that to go over the air without consulting me?
He made no move to light the cigarette. He had a young man's face, with an old man's wrinkles, and Link's yellow eyes. His ears stuck out.
Herr Neumann,
the mayor's representative said, trapping the phone receiver between his shoulder and a couple of chins and getting it quite sweaty.
Here in Berlin, our reflex is to shy away from censorship. We had enough of that in the bad old days. Na ja? I don't mean that. How are we to control this situation if we are not even informed when steps like this are taken?
He leaned back and stroked a finger down one of the furrows that bracketed his mouth.
This could turn into Munich all over again.
Takyan studied the digital clock built into the high heel of one of the pair of boots he'd bought on the Kudamm the day before. Aside from the clocks, he was in full 17th century regalia. This tour was a political stunt, he thought, but still we might have accomplished some good. Is this how it's going to end?
Who is this Al-Muezzin? He asked. Daud Hassani is his name. He's an ace who can destroy things with his voice, rather like your own late ace Howler, Neumann said.
If he noticed Takyan's wince, he gave no sign.
He's from Palestine. He's one of Nur al-Allah's people, works out of Syria. He claimed responsibility for the downing of that LL jetliner at Orly last June.
I'm afraid we've heard far from the last of the light of Allah, Takyan said. Neumann nodded grimly. Since the tour had left Syria, there had been 36 bombings worldwide in retribution for its treacherous attack on the Ace Prophet. If only that the wretched woman had finished the job, Tak thought. He was careful not to speak it aloud. These earthers could be sensitive about such things. Sweat ran down the side of his neck and into the lace collar of his blouse. The radiator hummed and groaned with heat. I wish they were less sensitive to cold. Why do these Germans insist on making their hot planet so much hotter? The door opened. Clamor spilled in from the International Press Corps, crammed into the corridor outside. A political aide slipped inside and whispered to the mayor's man. The mayor's man petulantly slammed down his phone.
Miss Morgenstern has come from the Kempinski, he announced.
Bring her in at once, Takyan said. The mayor's man jutted his underlip, which gleamed wet in the fluorescence.
Impossible! She is a member of the press, and we have excluded the press from this room for the duration.
Tachyon looked at the man down the length of his fine straight nose. I demand that Ms. Morgenstern be admitted at once. He said in that tone of voice reserved on tackies for grooms who tread on freshly polished boots and serving maids who spill soup on heads of allied Psylord houses who are guesting in the manor. Let her in, Neumann said. She's brought Herr John's tape for us. Sarah was wearing a white trench coat with a hand-wide belt red as a bloody bandage. Tack shook his head. Like all fashion statements she made, this one jarred. She came to him. They shared a brief dry embrace. She turned away, unslinging her heavy handbag. Tachyon wondered. Had that been a touch of metal in her watercolor eyes, or only tears?
Did you hear that? The redhead called Annika warbled. One of the pigs we got today was a Jew.
Early afternoon. The radio simmered with reports and conjectures about the kidnapping. The terrorists were exalted, strutting and puffing for each other's benefit.
One more drop of blood to avenge our brothers in Palestine, said Wolf sonorously.
What about the nigger ace? Demanded the one who looked like a lifeguard and answered to Ulrich. Has he died yet?
He's not going to any time soon, Annika said. According to the news, he walked out of the hospital within an hour of being admitted.
That's bullshit! I hit him with half a magazine! I saw that van fall on him!
Annika sidled over from the radio and ran her fingers along the line of Ulrich's jaw.
Don't you think if he can lift a van all by himself, he might be a little hard to hurt, sweetheart?
She stood up on the toes of her sneakers and kissed him just behind the lobe of his ear.
Besides, we killed two.
Three,
said Comrade Wilfried, who was still monitoring the airwaves.
The other policeman just died.
He swallowed. Annika clapped her hands in delight.
You see? I killed somebody too,
said the boy's voice from behind Hartman. Just the sound of it filled Puppet Man with energy. Easy, easy, Hartman cautioned his other half, wondering, do I have this one? Is it possible to create a puppet without knowing it? Or is he constantly emoting at such a pitch that I can feel it without having the link? The power didn't answer. The leather boy shuffled forward. Hartman saw he was hunchbacked. A joker?
Comrade Dieter, the teenager said, I often brrr like that.
He held his hands up in front of him, and suddenly they were vibrating like a power saw blade, a blur of lethality. An ace! Hartman's own breath hit him in the chest. The vibration stopped. The boy showed yellow teeth around at the others. They were very quiet. Through the pounding in his ears, Hartman heard a scrape of tubular metal on wood as the man in the coat got up from his chair.
You killed someone, Mackie? He asked mildly.
His German was a touch too perfect to be natural.
Why?
Mackie tucked his head down.
He was an informer, comrade,
he said sidelong. His eyes jittered between Wolf and the other.
Comrade Wolf ordered me to take him into custody, but he tried to kill me. That was it. He put a gun on me and I bust him off.
He brandished a vibrating hand again. The man came slowly forward where Hartman could see him. He was medium height, dressed well, but not too well. Hair neat and blonde. A man just on the handsome side of nondescriptness, except for his hands, which were encased in what appeared to be thick rubber gloves. Hartman watched them in sudden fascination.
Why wasn't I told of this, Wolf?
The voice stayed level, but Puppet Man could hear an unspoken shout of anger. There was sadness, too. The power was pulling it in, no question now, and a hell of a lot of fear. Wolf rolled heavy shoulders.
There was a lot going on this morning, Comrade Molnia. I learned that Dieter planned to betray us. I sent Mackie after him. Things got out of hand. But everything's all right now. Everything's going fine.
Facts dropped into place like tumblers in a lock. Molnia, lightning. Suddenly Hartman knew what had happened to him in the limousine. The gloved man was an ace, who'd used some kind of electric power to shock him under.
Hurtman's teeth almost splintered from the effort it took to bite back the terror.
An unknown ace. He'll know me. Find me out.
His other self was ice.
He doesn't know anything. But how can you know? We don't know his powers.
He's a puppet. It was a fight to keep his face from matching his emotion.
How the hell can that be?
I got him when he shocked me. Didn't even have to do anything. His own power fused our nervous systems for a moment. That's all it took.
Mackie squirmed like a puppy caught peeing on the rug.
Did I do right, Comrade Mulya?
Mulya's lips whitened, but he nodded with visible effort.
Yes, under the circumstances.
Mackie preened and strutted.
Well, that is, I executed an enemy of the revolution. You're not the only ones.
Annika clucked and brushed fingertips across Mackie's cheek.
Preoccupied with the search for individual glory, comrade? You're going to have to learn to watch those bourgeois tendencies if you want to be part of the Red Army faction.
Mackie licked his lips and slunk away, flushing. Puppet Man felt what was going on inside him, like the royal beneath the surface of the sun.
What about him?
Hartman asked. Him too, and the blonde jock as well. They both handled us after the Russian shocked you. That jolt made me hypersensitive. Hartman let his head drop forward to cover a frown. How could all this happen without my knowledge?
I'm your subconscious, remember? Always on the job.
Comrade Molnya sighed and returned to his seat. He felt hairs rise on the back of his hands and neck as his hyperactive neurons fired off. There was nothing he could do about low-level discharges such as this. They happened of their own accord under stress. This was why he wore gloves, and why some of the more lurid tales they told around the aquarium about his wedding night had damn near come to pass. He had to smile.
What's there to be tense about?
Even if he were identified for what he was, after the fact, there would be no international repercussions. That was how the game was played, by us and by them. So his superiors assured him.
Right. Good God, what did I do to deserve being caught up in this lunatic scheme?
He wasn't sure who was crazier, this collection of poor twisted men and bloodthirsty political knaves, or his own bosses. It was the opportunity of the decade, they told him. Al-Muezzin was in the vest pocket of the Big K. If we spring him, he'll fall into our hands out of gratitude. Work for us instead. He might even bring the light of Allah along. Was it worth the risk? He demanded. Was it worth blowing the underground contacts they'd been building in the Federal Republic for 10 years? Was it worth risking the big war? The war neither side was going to win no matter what their fancy paper war plan said. Reagan was president. He was a cowboy. A madman. But there was only so far you could push. Even if you were an ace and a hero. The first man into the Bala Hissar in Kabul on Christmas Day of 79. The gates had closed in his face. He had his orders. He needed no more. It wasn't that he disagreed with the goals. Their arch rivals, the Komitet Kusurvanoi Besupashnosti, the State Security Committee, were arrogant, overpraised, and undercompetent. No good GRU man could ever object to taking those assholes down a peg. As a patriot, he knew that military intelligence could make far better use of an asset as valuable as Dawood Hassani than their better-known counterparts, the KGB. But the method? It wasn't for himself he worried. It was for his wife and daughter. And for the rest of the world, too. The risk was enormous, should anything go wrong. He reached into a pocket for cigarettes and a lighter.
A filthy habit, Ulrich said in that lumbering way of his.
Molnya just looked at him. After a moment, Wolf produced a laugh that almost didn't sound forced.
The kids these days, they have a different standards. In the old days, Ricky baby. Comrade Meinhof, she was a smoker. Always had a cigarette going.
Molnya said nothing. Just kept staring at Ulrich. His eyes bore a trace of epicanthic fold, legacy of the Mongol yoke. After a moment, the blonde youth found somewhere else to look. The Russian lit up, ashamed of his cheap victory. But he had to keep these murderous young animals under control. What an irony it was that he, who had resigned from the Spetsnaz commandos and transferred to the Chief Intelligence Directorate of the Soviet General Staff because he could no longer stomach violence, should find himself compelled to work with these creatures for whom the shedding of blood had become addiction.
Oh, Mila, Masha, will I ever see you again?
Herr Doctor? Tak scratched the side of his nose. He was getting restive. He'd been cooped up here 2 hours, unsure of what he might be contributing. Outside, well, there was nothing to be done, but he might be with his people on the tour, comforting them, reassuring them. Herr Neumann, he acknowledged. The man from the Federal Criminal Office sat down next to him. He had a cigarette in his fingers, unlit despite the layer of tobacco that hung like a fog bank in the thick air. He kept turning it over and over. I wanted to ask your opinion. Takyan raised a magenta eyebrow. He had long since realized the Germans wanted him here solely because he was the tour's leader in Hartmann's absence. Otherwise, they would hardly have cared to have a medical doctor, and a foreigner at that, underfoot. As it was, most of the civil and police officials circulating through the crisis center treated him with the deference due his position of authority and otherwise ignored him. Escouet, Takyan said with a hand wave that was only faintly sardonic. Neumann seemed honestly interested, and he had shown signs of at least nascent intelligence, which in Dax's compass was rare for the breed. Were you aware that for the past hour and a half, several members of your tour have been trying to raise a sum of money to offer Senator Hartmann's kidnappers as ransom? No. Neumann nodded slowly, as if thinking something through. His yellow eyes were hooded. They are experiencing considerable difficulty. It is the position of your government, not my government, Neumann inclined his head, of the United States government, that there will be no negotiation with the terrorists. Needless to say, American currency restrictions did not permit the members of the tour to take anywhere near a sufficient amount of money from the country, and now the American government has frozen the assets of all tour participants to preclude their concluding a separate deal. Takyan felt his cheeks turn hot. That's them high-handed. Neumann shrugged. I was curious as to what you thought of the plan. Why me? You are an acknowledged authority on Jok affairs. That's the reason you honor our country with your presence, of course. He tapped a cigarette on the table next to a curling corner of a map of Berlin. Also, you come of a culture in which kidnapping is not an uncommon occurrence, if I do not misapprehend. Tak looked at him. Though he was a celebrity, most Earthers knew little of his background beyond the fact that he was an alien. I can't speak of the RAF, of course. The Rote Army Fraktion, in its current incarnation, consists primarily of middle-class youths, much like its previous incarnations, and for that matter, most First World Revolutionary groups. Money means little to them. As children of our so-called economic miracle, they have been raised always to assume a sufficiency of it. That's certainly not something you can say for the JJS, Sarah Morgenstern said, coming over to join the conversation. An aide moved to intercept her, reaching a hand to shepherd her away from the important masculine conversation. She shied away from him, as if a spark had jumped between them, and glared. Neumann said something brisk that not even Takyan caught. The aide retreated. Frau Morgenstern, I am also much interested in what you have to say. Members of the Jokers for a Just Society are authentically poor. I can vouch for that at least. Would money tempt them, then? That's hard to say. They are committed in a way I suspect the RAF members aren't. Still, a butterfly flip of the hand, they haven't lost any Mideastern aces. On the other hand, when they demand money to benefit jokers, I believe them, whereas that might mean less to the Red Army people. Tak frowned. The demand to knock down Jet Boy's tomb and build a Joker hospice rankled him. Like most New Yorkers, he wouldn't miss the memorial, an eyesore erected to honor failure, and one he'd personally prefer to forget. But the demand for a hospice was a slap in his face. When has a Joker been turned away from my clinic? When? Neumann was studying him. You disagree, Herr Doctor? He asked softly. No, she's right. But Gimli, he snapped his fingers and extended a forefinger. Tom Miller cares deeply for Jokers, but he also has an eye for what Americans call the main chance. You might well be able to tempt him. Sarah nodded. But why do you ask, Herr Neumann? After all, President Reagan refuses to negotiate for the senator's return. Her voice rang with bitterness. Soltak was puzzled. As high-strung as she was, he'd thought that surely worry for Greg would have broken her down by now. Instead, she seemed to be growing steadier by the hour. Neumann looked at her for a moment, and Tak wondered if he was in on the ill-kept secret of her affair with the missing senator. He had the impression those yellow eyes, red-rimmed now from the smoke, missed little. "Your president has made his decision," he said softly, "but it's my responsibility to advise my government on what course to take. This is a German problem too, you know." At 2:30, Hiram Worcester came on the air reading a statement in English. Tak-Yun translated it into German during the pauses. "Comrade Wolf, Gimli, if you're there," Hiram said, voice fluting with emotion. "We want the senator back. We're willing to negotiate as private citizens. Please, for the love of God, and for Jokers and Aces and all the rest of us, please, call us."
Molnya stared at the door. White enamel was coming away in flakes. Striae of green and pink and brown showed beneath the white, around gouges that looked as if someone had used the door for knife-throwing practice. He was all but oblivious to the others in the room, even the mad boy's incessant humming. He'd long since learned to tune that out for sanity's sake. "I should never have let them go." It took him aback when both Gimli and Wolf wanted to make the meet with the tour delegation. It was about the first thing they'd agreed on since this whole comic opera affair had gotten underway. He'd wanted to forbid them. He didn't like the smell of this rendezvous, but that was foolish. Reagan had closed the door on overt negotiation, but didn't the current Dirangate hearings with which the Americans were currently amusing themselves prove he was not averse to using private channels to deal with terrorists against whom he'd taken a hard public line? "Besides," he thought, "I've long since learned better than to issue orders I doubt will be obeyed." It had been so different in Spetsnaz. Men he'd commanded were professionals and more, the elite of the Soviet armed forces, full of esprit and skilled as surgeons. Such a contrast to this muddle of bitter amateurs and murderous dilettantes. If only he'd at least had someone trained back home, or in a camp in some Soviet client state, Korea or Iraq or Peru. Someone except Gimli, that is. He had the impression years had passed since anything but plastic would open the dwarf's mind enough to accept input from anyone else, Nats in particular. He wished at least he might have gone on the meet, but his place was here, guarding the captive. Without Hartmann, they had nothing, except a world full of trouble. "Does the KGB have this much trouble with his puppets?" Rationally, he guessed they did. They'd fluffed a few big ones over the years. The mention of Mexico could still make veterans wince, and GRU had evidence of plenty of missteps the Big K thought they'd covered up. But the Comitet's publicists had done their job well, on both sides of the quaintly named Iron Curtain. Down behind his forebrain, not even Molnya could shake the image of the KGB as the omniscient puppet master, with its strings wrapping the world like a spider's web. He tried to envision himself as a master spider. It made him smile. "No, I am not a spider, just a small frightened man whom somebody once called hero. He thought of Ludmila, his daughter. He shuddered. There are strings attached to me, right enough, but I'm not the one who pulled them.
I want him. Hartman looked around the squalid little room. Ulrich was pacing, face fixed and sullen at having been left behind. Stocky Wilfried sat cleaning an assault rifle with compulsive care. He always seemed to be doing something with his hands. The two remaining jokers sat by themselves, saying nothing. The Russian sat and smoked and stared at the wall. He studiously didn't look at the boy in the scuffed leather jacket. Maggie Messer hummed the old song about the shark and its teeth and the man with his jackknife and fancy gloves. Hartman remembered a mealy-mouth version popular when he was a teenager, sung by Bobby Darin or some such teen idol crooner. He also recalled a different version, one he'd heard for the first time in a dim, dope-fogged room on Yale's old campus when anti-war activist Hartman returned to his alma mater to lecture in 68. Dark and sinister, a straighter translation of the original, sung in the whiskey baritone of a man who, like old Bertolt Brecht himself, delighted in playing ball. Thomas Marion Douglas, Destiny's doomed lead singer. Remembering the way the words went down his spine on that distant night, he shuddered. I want him. No, his mind shouted. He's insane. He's dangerous. He could be useful once I get us out of here. Hartman's body clenched in rictus terror. No! Don't do anything. The terrorists are negotiating right now. We'll get out of this. He felt Puppet Man's disdain. Seldom had his alter ego seemed more discreet, more other. Fools. What has Hiram Worcester ever been involved in that amounted to anything? It'll fall through. Then we just wait. Sooner or later, something will be worked out. It's how these things go. He felt slimy vines of sweat twining his body inside his blood-spattered shirt and vest. How long do you think we have to wait? How long before our jokers and their terrorist friends blow up in each other's faces? I have puppets. They're our only way out. What can they do? I can't just make someone let me go. I'm not that little mind twister, Tachyon. He felt a smug vibration within. Don't forget 1976, he told his power. You thought you could handle that, too. The power laughed at him, until he closed his eyes and concentrated and forced it to quiescence. Has it become a demon, possessing me? He wondered. Am I just another of Puppet Man's puppets? No, I'm the master here. Puppet Man's just a fantasy, a personification of my power, a game I play with myself. Inside the tangled corridors of his soul, the echo of triumphant laughter.
It's raining again, Xavier Desmond said. Tack made a face and refrained from a rejoinder, commending the Joker's firm grasp of the obvious. Des was a friend, after all. He shifted his grip on the umbrella he shared with Desmond and tried to console himself that the squall would soon pass. The Berliners strolling the paths that veined the grassy Tiergarten Park and hurrying along the sidewalks of the nearby Bundesallee clearly thought so, and they should know. Old men in Hamburgs, young women with prams, intense young men in dark wool sweaters, a sausage vendor with cheeks like ripe peaches, the usual crowd of Germans taking advantage of anything resembling decent weather after the lengthy Prussian winter. He glanced at Hiram. The big round restaurateur was resplendent in his pinstripe three-piece suit, hat at a jaunty angle, and black beard curled. He had an umbrella in one hand, a gleaming black satchel in the other, and Sarah Morgenstern standing primly next to him, not quite making contact. Rain was dripping off the brim of Tack's plumed hat, which swept beyond the coverage of the cheap plastic umbrella. A rivulet ran down one side of Dez's trunk. Tack sighed. How did I let myself get talked into this? He wondered for the fourth or fifth time. It was idle
when Hiram had called to say a West German industrialist who wished to remain nameless had offered to front them the ransom money, he'd known he was in. Sarah stood stiff. He sensed she was shivering, almost subliminally. Her face was the color of her raincoat. Her eyes were a paleness that somehow contrasted. He wished she hadn't insisted on coming along, but she was the leading journalist on this junket. They'd have had to lock her up to keep her from covering this meeting with Hartman's kidnappers at first hand, and there was her personal interest. Hiram cleared his throat. "Here they come!" His voice was pitched higher than usual. Tachyon glanced right without turning his head. No mistake. There weren't enough jokers in West Germany that it was likely to have two just happen along at this moment, even if there could be any doubt about the identity of the small bearded man who walked with the Toulouse-Lautrec roll beside a being who looked like a beige anteater on its hind legs. "Doom," Hiram said, voice husky now.
"Gimli,"
the dwarf replied. He said it without heat. His eyes glittered at the satchel hanging from Hiram's hand.
"You brought it."
"Of course, Gimli."
He handed the umbrella to Sarah and cracked the satchel. Gimli stood on tiptoe and peered in. His lips pursed in a soundless whistle.
$2 million American dollars? Two more? After you hand Senator Hartman over to us?"
A snaggletooth grin.
"That's a bargaining figure."
Hiram colored.
"You agreed on the phone?"
"We agreed to consider your offer once you demonstrated your good faith,"
said one of the two gnats who accompanied Gimli and his partner. He was a tall man made bulkier by his raincoat. Dark blonde hair was slicked back and down from a balding promontory of forehead by the intermittent rain.
"I am Comrade Wolf. Let me remind you, there's the matter of the freedom of our comrade, Al-Muezzin."
"Just what is it that makes German socialists risk their lives and freedom on behalf of a fundamentalist Muslim terrorist?" Tachyon asked.
"We're all comrades in the struggle against Western imperialism. What brings a Tachyon to risk his health in our beastly climate on behalf of a senator from a country that once whipped him from its shores like a rabid dog?"
Tack drew his head back in surprise, and then he smiled. "Touché." He and Wolf shared a look of perfect understanding.
"But we can only give you money," Hiram said. "We can't arrange for Mr. Hassani to be released. We told you that."
"Then it's no sale,"
said Wolf's gnat companion, a red-headed woman Tack could have found attractive but for a sullen, puffy jut to her lower lip and a bluish cast to her complexion.
"What use is your toilet paper money to us? We merely demand it to make you pig sweat."
"Now, wait a minute," Gimli said. "That money can buy a lot for jokers."
"Are you so obsessed with buying into consumption fascism?"
sneered the redhead. Gimli went purple.
"The money's here. Hassani's in Rikers, and that's a long way away."
Wolf was frowning at Gimli in a speculative sort of way. Somewhere, an engine backfired. The woman spat like a cat and jumped back, face pale, eyes feral. Motion tugged at the corner of Tack's eye. The chubby sausage seller had flipped open the lid of his cart. His hand was coming out with a black Heckler & Koch mini-machine pistol in it. Ever suspicious, Gimli traced his gaze.
"It's a trap!" he shrieked.
He whipped open his coat. He'd been holding one of those compact little Krenkov assault rifles beneath. Tachyon kicked the foreshortened Kalashnikov from Gimli's hand with the toe of an elegant boot. The gnat woman pulled out an AKM from inside her coat and started a burst, one-handed. The sound threatened to implode Tack's eardrums. Sarah screamed. Tack threw himself onto her, bore her down to wet, fragrant grass as the female terrorist tracked her weapon from left to right, face a rictus of something like ecstasy. There was motion all around. Old men in Homburgs and young women with prams and intense young men in sweaters were whipping out machine pistols and rushing towards the party clumped around the two umbrellas.
Wait! Hiram shouted. Hold on! It's all a misunderstanding!
The other terrorists had guns out now, firing in all directions. Bystanders screamed and scattered. The slick-soled shoes of a man waving a machine pistol with one hand lost traction on the grass and shot out from under him. A man with an MP5K and a business suit tripped over a baby carriage whose operator had frozen on the handle and fell on his face. Sarah lay beneath Tachyon, rigid as a statue. The clenched rump pressed against his crotch was firmer than he would have expected. This is the only way I'm ever going to get on top of her, he thought, ruefully. It was almost physical pain to realize it was contact with him and not the fear of the bullets crackling like static overhead that made her go stiff. Greg, you are a lucky man, should you somehow survive this imbroglio. Scrambling after his rifle, Gimli ran into a big gnat who snatched at him. He picked him up by one leg with that disproportionate strength of his and pitched him into the faces of a trio of his comrades like a Scot tossing the caber. Dez was making love to the grass. Smart man, Tachyon thought. His head was full of burned powder and the green and brown aromas of wet turf. Hiram was wandering dazed through a horizontal firestorm, waving his arms and crying, "Wait, wait! Oh, it wasn't supposed to happen like this!" The terrorists bolted. Gimli ducked between the legs of one gnat, who flailed his arms at him in a grab, came up and punched a second in the nuts and followed them. Tack heard a squeal of pain. The snouted joker fell down, with black, ropey strands of blood unraveling from his belly. Gimli caught him up on the run and slung him over his shoulder like a rolled carpet. A gaggle of Catholic schoolgirls scattered like blue quail, pigtails flying as the fugitives stampeded through them. Tachyon saw a man go to one knee, raise his machine pistol for a burst at the terrorists. He reached out with his mind. The man toppled, asleep. A van coughed into life and roared from the curb with Gimli thrashing for the handles of the open doors with his stubby arms. Hiram sat on the wet grass, weeping into his hands, the black satchel wept bundled money beside him.
"The political police," Neumann said, as if trying to work a shred of spoiled food from inside his mouth. "They don't call them popo for nothing." "Herr Neumann," the man in mechanics coveralls began beseechingly.
"Shut up! Dr. Tachyon, you have my personal apology."
Neumann had arrived within 5 minutes of the terrorists' escape, just in time to keep Tachyon from being arrested for screaming abuse at the police interlopers. Tachyon sensed Sarah beside and behind him like a whiteout shadow. She'd just finished narrating a sketch of what had just happened into the voice-actuated mic clipped to the lapel of her coat. She seemed calm. He gestured at the ambulances crowded together like whales with spinning blue lights beyond the police cordon, with a hat still bedraggled from being jumped up and down on.
"How many people did your madmen gun down?"
"Three bystanders were injured by gunfire and one policeman. Another officer will require hospitalization, but he, was not shot."
"What were you thinking of?" Tachyon screamed. He thought he'd blasted all his fury out of him, all over the plainclothes officers who'd been stumbling across each other, demanding to know how the terrorists could possibly have gotten away. But now it was back, filling him up to overflow. "Tell me, what did you people think you were doing?"
"It wasn't my people," Neumann said. "It was the political branch of the Berlin Land Police. The Bundeskriminalamt had nothing to do with it."
"It was all a setup," Xavier Desmond said, stroking his trunk with leaden fingers. "That millionaire philanthropist who lent the ransom was fronting for the political police."
"Herr Neumann,"
it was a popo with grass stains on the knees of his once sharply pressed trousers, pointing an accusing finger at Tachyon.
He let the terrorists go. Pauly had a clear shot at them, and he knocked them down with that mind power of his.
The officer was aiming his weapon at a crowd of people through whom the terrorists were fleeing, Tack said tartly. He could not have fired without hitting innocent bystanders, or perhaps I am confused as to who is the terrorist. The plainclothesman turned red. You interfered with one of my officers. We could have stopped them. Neumann reached out and grabbed a pinch of the man's cheek. Go elsewhere, he said softly. Really? The man swallowed and walked away, sending hostile looks back over his shoulder at Tachyon. Tachyon grinned and shot him a bird.
Oh, Greg, my God, what have we done? Sobbed Hiram. We'll never get him back.
Tachyon tugged on his elbow, more trying to encourage him to his feet than help him. He forgot about Hiram's gravity power. The fat man popped right up.
What do you mean, Hiram, my friend?
Are you out of your mind, Doctor? They'll kill him now. Sarah gasped. When Tack glanced to her, she looked quickly away, as if unwilling to show him her eyes.
Not so, my friend, Neumann said. That's not how the game is played.
He stuck hands in the pockets of his trousers and gazed off across the misty park at the line of trees that masked the outer fences of the zoo.
But now, the price will go up.
The bastards!
Gimli turned, whipping rain from the tail of his raincoat and beat fists on the mottled walls.
The cocksuckers! They set us up!
Shroud and Scrape were huddled over the thin, filthy mattress on which Aardvark lay moaning softly. Everybody else seemed to be milling around a room crowded with heavy damp as well as bodies. Hartman sat with his head pulled protectively down inside his sweat-limp collar. He agreed with Gimli's character assessment. Are these fools trying to get me killed? A thought went home like a whaler's bomb lance.
Tachyon!
Does that alien demon suspect? Is this a convoluted Takesian plot to get rid of me without a scandal? Puppet Man laughed at him. Never attribute to malice what may adequately be explained by stupidity, he said. Hartman recognized the quote. Lady Black had said it to Carnifex once, during one of his rages. Mackie Messer stood shaking his head.
This isn't right, he said, half-pleading. We have the Senator, don't they know that?
Then he was raging around the room like a cornered wolf, snarling and hacking air with his hands. People jostled to get out of the way of those hands.
What do they think is going on? Maggie screamed. Who do they think they're fucking with? I'll tell you something. I'll tell you what. Maybe we should send them a few pieces of the Senator here. Show them what's what.
He buzzed his hands inches from the tip of the captive's nose. Hartman yanked his head back. Christ, he almost got me. The intent had been there for real. Puppet Man had felt it waver at the final millisecond.
Calm down, Detlef, Annika said sweetly. She seemed exalted by the shootout in the park. She'd been fluttering around and laughing at nothing since the group's return, and red spots glowed like grease paint on her cheeks. The capitalists won't be eager to pay all we ask for damaged goods.
Mackie went white. Puppet Man felt fresh anger burst inside him like a bomb.
Mackie! I'm Mackie Messer, you fucking bitch! Mackie, the knife, just like my song!
Detlef was slang for faggot, Hartman remembered. He kept his last breath inside. Annika smiled at the youthful ace. From the side of his eye, Hartman saw Wilfried pale, and Ulrich picked up an AKM with an elaborate casualness he wouldn't have thought the blonde terrorist could muster. Wolf put his arm around Mackie's shoulders. There, Mackie, there. Annika didn't mean anything by it. Her smile made a liar of him, but Mackie pressed against the big man's side and allowed himself to be gentled. Molnia cleared his throat, and Ulrich set the rifle down. Hartman let the breath go. The explosion wasn't coming. Quite yet. He's a good boy, Wolf said, giving Mackie another hug and letting him go. He's the son of an American deserter and a Hamburg whore, another victim of your imperialist venture in Southeast Asia, Senator.
My father was a general, Mackie shouted in English.
Yes, Mackie, anything you say. The boy grew up running the docks and alleys, in and out of institutions. Finally, he drifted to Berlin. More helpless flotsam cast up by our own frenetic consumer culture. He saw posters, began to attend study groups at the Free University. He's barely literate, the poor child. And that's where I found him and recruited him. And he's been so helpful, Annika said, rolling her eyes at Ulrich, who laughed. Mackie glanced at them, then quickly away. You win, Puppet Man said. What? You're right. My control isn't perfect. And this one is too unpredictable, too terrible. Hartman almost laughed aloud. Of all the things he'd come to expect from the power that dwelt within him, humility wasn't one. Such a waste. He'd be such a perfect puppet, and his emotions so furious, so lovely, like a drug, but a deadly drug. So you've given up. Relief flooded him. No, the boy just has to die. But that's all right. I've got it all worked out now. Shroud squatted over Aardvark like a solicitous mummy, bathing his forehead with a length of his own bandage, which he dipped in water from one of the 5-liter plastic cans stacked in the bedroom. He shook his head and murmured to himself. Eyes malice bright, Annika danced up to him.
Thinking of all that lovely money you lost, comrade?
Joker's blood been shed. Again, Shroud said levelly. It better not have been for nothing. Annika sauntered over to Ulrich.
You should have seen them, sweetheart. All ready to hand Senator Schweinfleisch over for a suitcase full of dollars. She pursed her lips. I do believe they were so excited they forgot all about the frontline fighter we sworn to liberate. They would have sold us all.
Shut up, you bitch, Gimli yelled.
Spittle exploded from the center of his beard as he lunged for the redhead. With a scratch of chitin on wood, Scrape interposed himself, threw his horny arms around his leader as guns came up. A loud pop stopped them like a freeze frame. Monia stood with a bare hand upturned before his face, fingers extended as if to hold a ball. An ephemeral blue flicker limned the nerves of his hand and was gone.
If we fight among ourselves, he said calmly, we play into our enemy's hands.
Only Puppet Man knew his calm was a lie. Deliberately, Molnya drew his glove back on.
We were betrayed. What more can we expect from the capitalist system we oppose? He smiled. Let us strengthen our resolve. If we stand together, we can make them pay for their treachery.
The potential antagonists fell back away from each other. Hartman feared. Puppet Man exulted.
The last of the bay lay across the Brandenburg Plain, west of the city, like a layer of polluted water. From the next block, tinny Near Eastern music skirled from a radio. Inside the little room, it was tropical. From the heat billowing out of the radiator that the handy comrade Wilfred had got going despite the building's derelict status, as well as electricity, from the humidity of bodies confined under stress. Ulrich let the cheap curtains drop and turned away from the window.
Christ, it stinks in here, he said, doing stretches. What do these fucking Turks do? Piss in the corners?
Lying on the foul mattress next to the wall, Aardvark huddled closer around his injured gut and whimpered. Gimli moved over beside him, felt his head. His ugly little face was all knotted up with concern.
It's in a bad way, the dwarf said.
Maybe we ought to get him to a hospital, Scrape said. Ulrich jutted his square chin and shook his head.
No way, we decided.
Shroud knelt down next to his boss, took Aardvark's hand, and felt the low, fuzzy forehead.
He's got some fever.
How can you tell? Wilfried asked, his broad face concerned. Maybe he's naturally got a higher temperature than a person. Like a dog or something. Quick as a teleport, Gimli was across the room. He swept Wilfried off his feet with a transverse kick and straddled his chest, pummeling him. Shroud and Scrape hauled him off. Wilfried was holding his hands up before his face. Hey, what did I do? He seemed almost in tears. You stupid bastard! Gimli howled, windmilling his arms. You're no better than the rest of the fucking gnats! None of you!
Comrades, please, Molnya began. But Gimli wasn't listening. His face was the color of raw meat. He sent his companions flying with a heave of his shoulders and marched to Utvok's side.
Puppet Man hated to let Gimli off like this, walking away clear. He'd have to kill the evil little fuck someday. But survival surmounted even vengeance. Puppet Man's imperative was to shave the odds against him. This was the quickest way.
Tears streamed over Gimli's lumpy cheeks.
That's enough, he sobbed. We're taking him for medical attention. And we're taking him now.
He bent down and looped a limp furry arm over his neck. Shroud glanced around, eyes alert above the bandage wrap, then joined him. Comrade Wolf blocked the door.
Nobody lives here.
What the fuck are you talking about, little man?
Ulrich said pugnaciously.
He's not hurt that badly.
Who says he's not, eh? Shroud said. For the first time, Hartman realized he had a Canadian accent. Gimli's face twisted like a rag.
That's shit! He's hurting! He's dying! Damn it! Let us go!
Ulrich and Annika were sidling for their weapons.
United we stand, brother, Wolf intoned. Defeated we fall. As you armies say.
A double clack brought their heads around. Scrape stood by the far wall. The assault rifle he'd just cocked was pointed at the buckle of the blonde terrorist's army belt.
Then maybe we just fell, comrades, he said. Because if Gimli says we're going, we're gone.
Wolf's mouth crumpled in on itself, as if he were old and had forgotten his false teeth. He glanced at Ulrich and Annika. They had the Jokers flanked. If they all moved at once. Clinging to one of Aardvark's wrists, Shroud brought up an AKM with his free hand.
Keep it cool, Nat.
Mackie felt his hands beginning to buzz. Only the touch of Molnia's hand on his arm kept him from slicing some Joker meat.
Ugly monsters. I knew we couldn't trust them.
What about the things we're working for?
The Soviet asked. Gimli wrung Aardvark's hand.
This is what we're working for. He's a Joker, and he needs help.
Comrade Wolf's face was turning the color of eggplant. Veins stood out like broken fingers on his temples.
Where do you think you're going?
He forced past grinding teeth. Gimli laughed.
Right through the wall, where our friends are waiting for us.
Then leave. Walk out on us. Walk out on the great things you were going to do for your fellow monsters. We still have the Senator. We are going to win. And if we ever catch you...
Scrape laughed.
You're gonna have trouble catching your breath after this goes down. The pigs will be crawling all over you, I guarantee. You're such total fuck-ups, I can smell it.
Ulrich's eyes were rolling belligerently, despite the rifle aimed at his midsection.
No, Molnia said. Let them go. If we fight, everything is lost. Get out, Wolf said.
Yeah, Gimli said.
He and Shroud gently carried Aardvark out into the unlit hallway of the abandoned building. Scrape covered them until they were out of sight, then swiftly crossed the room. He paused, gave them as much of a smile as chitin would permit, and closed the door. Ulrich hurled his Kalashnikov against the door. Fortunately, it failed to go off.
Bastards!
Annika shrugged. Clearly, she was bored with the psychodrama.
Americans, she said.
Mackie sidled over to Molnia. Everything seemed wrong. But Molnia would make it right. He knew he would.
The Russian ace was cake.